You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Leonard.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm not going to complain. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Leonard Heim, very well-known researcher of tech policy, especially AI policy, with particular emphasis on the hardware side, I guess. You know a lot about microchips. You've written a lot about U.S. Chip export restrictions as they pertain to China. I want to get into that eventually because I'm a little bit of a skeptic of that policy. But you're very conversant in a lot of stuff I want to talk about, AI governance broadly, maybe some of the business aspects of it, including like NVIDIA and things that Jensen Huang has recently gotten attention for saying about export controls. He's very down on them, as you know. I wanted to start off with something pretty topical, which is Mythos, which, as most people know, is this as yet unreleased model produced by Anthropic. Anthropic says that it would be irresponsible to release it now because it turns out that it's so good at hacking, at finding and even exploiting vulnerabilities. So for now, it is sharing it with kind of the maintainers of key infrastructure like Microsoft and so on, so they can use it to find holes and fix them. Now, that has implications for U.S.-China stuff. I want to get into that. But there's also a little bit of a controversy about the extent to which, if any, Anthropic is overstating the model's power for marketing purposes. I'm wondering if you have a take on that.
What I think about this, as a long-time AI believer, I think like we knew at some point AI cyber capabilities are going to get better. Mm-hmm. And I think what is certainly right is idea of like this structured release or like responsible release procedure. It's nothing new. People back in the days even did it for GPT-2, which I think many now say was a massive mistake. I'm a cautious guy. I like us to be like, we're to be safe and sorry on all of these technologies. Mm-hmm. And I think for Mythos, again, it's really hard to evaluate as a third party independent, but I think what we've seen in terms of like vulnerabilities it can find, I think it's good to give people an idea time to patch it. That's nothing mm-hmm. new. We do this like in cyber since forever, right? That's the whole mm-hmm. idea about CVEs, critical vulnerability. I don't even know what the E stands for.
Exploits
Exploits, I think something along these lines. It's just like when people submit an exploit, before they tell the world, they tell the developers, like, hey, by the way, I found this. Mm-hmm. You get a couple of days, weeks to fix it. I think we want to do the similar thing here. There's a debate, of course, if they would release it, it's not like they put the model weight out there and everybody can do whatever they want with it, right? They still would only release it via an API. They could still monitor what it's being used for. But I think that doing it this way and giving like access to the companies and give them time to patch it and also deploy these patches seems important. I think the importance of this will only go up over time. So I don't believe that this is marketing.
You don't think they're overstating? It really is something of a leap in capability.
I think I would say it's like this. It has this dual use, right? It's certainly good marketing. I wouldn't undermine that. I think it certainly sounds like really good in terms of marketing. Like, look, we built like the best cyber weapon, if you want to call it this way, ever out there. Is it a real leap? Hard to evaluate from the outside what we've seen. I think it's the case that already models before were pretty good at like finding vulnerabilities. And I think now we hit this and like they just tested it on a couple of like existing big open source libraries where they found a bunch of vulnerabilities, which if they would have been exploited in the wild would have been pretty bad. I think so. There's some counter pushback in terms of just like, you know, we nerds, we engineers, we always like to talk about 0 days, really complex exploits versus most things in the world. If they still get hacked, it's like phishing. It's a human factor, right? Mm-hmm. I expect like probably most cyber damage just goes back to that. Does it make a big difference there? No, the models before could also already write good phishing emails, right? So I don't necessarily believe we would have seen a massive increase in like cyber damage based on this model. But if you think about national security, where it's not necessarily about the damage, where just like you would hack like critical government infrastructure, or even just for governments out there in the world who are keeping the 0 days close to their chest. Mm-hmm. Maybe the 0 days will not be found by this model, right? So it would be interesting to see if some governments in the world right now are trying to use the 0 days if they have any available, because the model might soon find them.
And by the way, why are they called 0 days? What does that mean about the nature of the vulnerability?
basically mean it hasn't been disclosed. So it's been 0 days that people have been knowing about this. So in case of 0 day, it's the first time you find it. Nobody else has been out there. Nobody else had time to like publish it. And
so strictly speaking, 24 hours after you find it, it's no longer 0 days.
Technology zero. Well, if you tell the world, I think then it doesn't, qualify
as
0 day.
Anyway. As long as it's a secret, it's 0 days. By the way, speaking of national security, I forgot to mention actually that until recently you were a professor of policy analysis at RAND's School of Public Policy, and also on the, I guess, leading the compute team at the Center on AI, Security, and Technology at RAND. And you also were a co-founder of EPOCH, E-P-O-C-H, a very well-known AI research thing.
Been around for AI for quite a while. At some point, I did draw some lines, which started early on before EPOCH was a thing. And mm-hmm. the lines were pretty straight, and I kind of believed in them.
And they kept,
they've
and
been
you
right,
were right
ever since then. Yeah.
Okay, so you were early on the, I don't know if alarm is the word. You were concerned early on, I think, about some of the implications. You think it's something we need to think about very carefully.
Certainly. I think as every, I'm an engineer by training, right? Mm-hmm. So I am mostly for to think about technology as a force for good. And I think initially I was excited. I was like, wow, we can build machines who can do all labor for us. And then, you know, as an engineer, you talk to other engineers and they barely think about the social consequences of this. And at some point, I stumbled upon what the bigger implications in the long term, but also just what this means for the world. And I was like, oh, gosh, mm-hmm. what does it mean? And then even then, ever since, I'm like, I mean, you mentioned I've been covering all kinds of topics. I wouldn't claim I'm an expert in any of them. I just cover from hardware engineering, how chips are being made, up to AI policy, and I dabble in all of them. So I think I have a good overview of the stack. Mm-hmm. On all of these topics. And yeah, that's what I've been doing ever since.
One thing I'm wondering is, how do you think the Chinese government is processing this Mythos news? I mean, let's assume that they accept the premise that this is, you know, if not a quantum leap, like a big advance. And America has it. And, you know, I mean, I gather our government now has it right. I mean, I guess the Trump administration decided to patch up its relationship with Anthropic after this announcement. So if you're China and it's being used, you know, to tighten security on the part of the infrastructure run by like Western companies, but I think has not been offered to like Baidu and Huawei to fix the things they maintain. And you know it's in the hands of the U.S. government. Like, what are you thinking right now?
I mean, as usual, it's like hard to say. Well, how does the CCP? I don't think they have a unified view. I don't think the U.S. government has a unified view on this. And mm-hmm. I think, given the Anthropic debacle before, I think there's like quite different camps there. I think what's easier to convince here are people who work with. On cybersecurity on a day-to-day basis. And I think mm-hmm. most cybersecurity experts I've talked to, especially those who have access to this model, do believe that this is a big advantage and this is important. How would China react right now? I think to some degree, I think it raises the importance for national security. Right? Mm-hmm. Before, like AI, like most you think about in terms of business, productivity, everything you can imagine. And I think this is the first time a real example where we might actually have many of the threats and dangers many people talked about become a bit more realistic. Again, mm-hmm. I think it's the end of the world. I think everything will be mostly all right with this model. And then certainly they will have an interest in this. And I think certainly they're probably asking their companies when their model is coming on these kinds of things. And mm-hmm. Chinese companies have also been like working on like models for cyber security and vulnerabilities for a long time. This is known as every state does,
sure.
right? So it's like unclear exactly what are their capabilities and how are they thinking about that.
Although this capability seems to emerge almost as a byproduct of building a model that's good at coding. I mean, that's what Anthropic said,
indeed.
Right? It didn't set out to build a hacker. This capability is just intrinsic in being a good coding agent.
Yeah.
So the one reason I ask, you're probably familiar with this superintelligence strategy paper by Dan Hendricks, Eric Schmidt. It came out about a year ago. And one scenario in it, this isn't maybe quite the thing that got the most attention. I kind of thought it should have, but it was just the idea that if you accept the premise that there's this thing out there called superintelligence, mm-hmm. and you're one of the two superpowers, and the other superpower seems to be on the verge of having it, whereas you are like 6 months away. And of course, the premise, widely accepted idea in certain communities is that once you get close to this threshold, things are moving super fast, and it's a big yeah. threshold. So if you're 6 months behind, you're like way, way, way behind for practical purposes. But because once the other side, your rival, gets the super intelligence, they're just going to have way more power to do not just military stuff, but all kinds of ways to mess with mm-hmm. you. Anyway, the scenario in the paper was the rival that's behind would have an incentive to stop AI progress, even if it took dramatic action, like bombing data centers, whatever. And so there's a destabilizing effect of two rivals racing towards superintelligence, especially mm-hmm. if one of them is ahead. And one thing you used to hear in response to that is, well, okay, but you know, China's not AGI pilled. In other words, they mm-hmm. don't have the same belief a lot of Americans do that you will be granted all these superpowers at that point. But one thing I thought is like, well, okay, but if they're reflecting on this mythos thing, you know, they may appreciate more deeply than before how dire it could be to be very far behind the U.S.
So
this could, in other words, make the race more destabilizing in effect. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, I think the rough line of argument seems right. It's just really hard to follow the line to its extremes. Right. So again, like this idea of just like having like this preemptive strike, even a preemptive war, to cross this boundary is incredibly high. Like mm-hmm. historically, we might have even had this for nukes. And even with nukes, like we didn't even exactly know what it is and what we're building there. Mm-hmm. And we never really know where exactly this threshold is. For AI, I think it just becomes harder. We were just talking about mythos. So I think we both agree it's better at cyber capabilities. If we just crossed the threshold, we became like too destabilizing? Is it just fine? It's just like really hard to assess mm-hmm. how bad it actually is. And I think that's like a big problem for countries and others. I'm just like, assuming you believe in all of this, like when is the threshold? Where's AGI? Where is superintelligence? Mm-hmm. I think this will just be a continuous debate. It will never be this one point. And even if you have other governments who are like, let's just call them more AGI pilled, it's not like they agree, right? It's not like the US government or even AI companies. Like, it's not that anybody agrees on anything, where we are with AI, how good it is, when are we going to cross it and when not. And I think this just makes it incredibly hard to this, because for having this idea of like this main paper, we need to have a collective agreement on where this threshold is, right? And we don't have that really. And with nukes, it was a bit easier. Right,
you mean we need to have collective agreement if we're going to like work something out with them cooperatively or what?
Well, if we would like work something out, we need to like mm-hmm. get agreement. But even in like, even if you don't want to work something out, you want to do like this preemptive strike in that case, you as the other country need to figure out when do we do this preemptive strike? Where is the line? Right. And I think that's like really, really hard to figure out. Yeah. And maybe once it's going there and we have like a recursive improving AI, it becomes obvious. Right. And I think these things are definitely on the table.
Right.
It's part of the reason why I want verification. I want countries to talk to each other because they're like many shared risks on this one. Though, again, I think it's just an incredibly hard line. I've been around for long enough. I've been talking about AGI for a long time. And it just becomes like this moving goalpost and everybody has a different definition. And even when systems are as good as they do today, I still talk to many mm-hmm. people. Like I'm in DC, in Washington, DC. Until half a year ago, people thought AI is a bubble. You know, mm-hmm. and it came up during every roundtable. And I'm just constantly trying to remind people that I think it's a bit more real. And I think the capabilities are actually advancing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in terms of like staging a strike, of course, one contingent and potentially important fact of current geopolitics is the fact that all the most advanced chips are made in Taiwan, and we are denying China access to those chips. So, the thing that it's easiest to imagine if China wanted to disrupt our progress is to do something they might be tempted to do for other reasons. Which is to go ahead and stage an attack on Taiwan. That's been a source of concern to me. It's one reason mm-hmm. I've been skeptical of the chip controls, and I've always wished that aspect of them would get more attention, which is that, at least theoretically, in terms of game theory, denying China the advanced chips coming out of that factory must increase by at least some percentage the likelihood of China doing something dramatic in Taiwan. It's just, you know, yeah. it used to be when the chips coming out of that factory were going to both China and the West, it was almost a deterrent, right? I mean, it was like neither side wanted to blow up the factory. Now that has shifted. And I guess, and I think mythos makes this so concrete. It makes the whole race to superintelligence thing more concrete and maybe more threatening to China is the thing I'm raising.
Yeah, I think that seems roughly right. I think this was broadly saying about improving AI capabilities, right? Mm-hmm. When we go back to these export controls you just mentioned again, there's a whole package. There are different parts which are being export controls. AI chips are being part of it. This goes back to 2019 when we first controlled the tools to make chips. Mm-hmm. And then 2022 where these chips were controlled. I think it's important to say in 2019. So what happened in 2019, Trump banned so-called EUV, extreme ultraviolet lithography machines built by this company, ASML in the Netherlands, from going to mm-hmm. China. If we now think about Taiwan, so what happened there is the machine which builds the most advanced chips can't go to China anymore. Mm-hmm. But it still can go to Taiwan. Sorry, I think I misspoke before.
Right.
This means this would actually decrease the chance of invading Taiwan because you could say, well, China, you're more reliant on Taiwan because it's right. The only place in the world which can produce these really advanced chips, right? So this is part of export controls.
I think so wait, you were saying in a certain sense it could decrease the incentive or...
The controls on the so-called chip-making equipment, on semiconductor manufacturing equipment, increases the reliance of China on Taiwan,
but the chip
right? because they produce
restrictions
the best chips.
have the opposite effect.
Indeed, but with the chip uh-huh. restrictions, it's important.
Right.
It's only AI chips. So China is still producing tons of chips at TSMC, tons of chips at in Taiwan generally. There's mm-hmm. lots of trade going on. There is one, again, it started as a narrow exception. I think now it's fair to say with AI eating the world, it's not that narrow anymore. The Chinese companies can't go to TSMC and produce advanced AI chips. Mm-hmm. They had success there, right? There was like in 2024, there was like a big case where they did this and TSMC didn't properly verify it. So like one of the leading chips was still produced
and
there.
We should say that's the name of the company in Taiwan that that makes the chips.
Indeed, the T stands for Taiwan.
TSMC. Okay.
Pretty basic name.
Yeah.
Indeed. So I think it goes both ways here. Overall, I follow with you the argument through, which is like, well, the US right now is reliant on Taiwan for the majority of its AI chips, the large majority of its AI chips, mm-hmm. and also part of the packaging and other parts of the supply chain, versus China is not. So in terms of the cost to AI, you're right. The invasion of Taiwan, depending on what happens to fabs, would like pose a larger cost to the US. This would have also been the case before because the US would just buy more chips anyway. So relatively, this would have been the case. What I would just debate here, and again, that's like where China expert should come in, to which degree this is part of the calculus overall. I think this was never a big part of it. I think it's fair to assume with AI getting better, it becomes a larger share of the calculus mm-hmm. On this one. But again, the impact of the Taiwan invasion goes far beyond beyond AI chips.
The other thing is, of course, the chip export restrictions have stimulated China to accelerate something it was doing anyway, which is to try to develop its indigenous chip making capability. But it's really put that on steroids. So whatever the date is at which it could say, hey, we're in a pretty good shape to survive the demise of chip making on Taiwan, whatever that date is, it's closer now as a result of the export restrictions because they've shifted into high gear in making their own chips.
Yeah, I mean, let's walk through this argument, right? I think what many people always misunderstand that China only started their indigenous chip production because mm-hmm. of the export controls. This is not mm-hmm. true. They've mm-hmm. done this before. Are they not going stronger? I think that's a fair argument, right? I would also go stronger if somebody restricts me from something. So let's say they're pouring no more money into producing advanced AI chips. They've been building a lot of things anyways, which you could get from local. If we look at, for example, car manufacturing, right? So I think they have the goal of indigenous manufacturing in many things. And they're just trying mm-hmm. to replace their competitors. That's quite normal. On the chip making, on the example, like, are they getting better? Yes, they're getting better. But they're still getting better with all of the machines they're using. They still come from ASML. These are still the lithography machines from ASML. And guess what? ASML is still servicing them. So for example, if there would be Taiwan invasion, ASML could say tomorrow, and I expect there would be a lot of US pressure, for them to stop servicing these machines. Mm-hmm. So there is still the ways where it can go both ways, and there's still dependencies, right? When we talk about China's semiconductor supply chain, many people think it's completely indigenous, and that's not the case. There's still mm-hmm. many things which are coming from Korea, which are coming from Japan, which are even coming from US companies or Dutch companies. Mm-hmm. What these export controls do, they try to carve out basically anything at 40 nanometer and below. With nanometers, like how small we try to make our transistors there, and the smaller, the better chip is. This is what it tries to carve out there. So there's still a dependency in both ways, though this dependency decreases over time, of course, as they're trying to indigenize there. And then one could debate how long does it take. My personal view, this takes a long time. We talk about the most complex thing we as humans have ever produced. advanced chips are incredibly complex. I think the idea that China can't manufacture anything is in most cases a bad idea. They're incredibly good at this. Mm-hmm. I think we have like some examples of high, like of technology, of the most complex technology, like semiconductors, where I just truly believe it's hard. And this is also not China versus the US. This is China versus the rest of the world. When we talk about a semiconductor supply chain, it's not like America invented everything. This is many, many countries, basically the world coming together, developing mm-hmm. this with many dependencies across the globe.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a couple of questions about Mythos. First of all, so does Anthropic have the capability to let a company use this model to search for vulnerabilities in its own software? And could Anthropic still be confident that they're not doing anything else with it? I mean, like, so in principle, they could like say to Baidu as a goodwill gesture or something, okay, here, fix your infrastructure, and we'll know that you don't, of course, you obviously don't have the model itself, you don't have the weights, but we'll also not be able to monitor, and we'll know that you're not like, letting the Chinese government look for vulnerabilities in our software or anything like that. Can they control it that tightly?
I mean, technically, they can, right? Because mm-hmm. technically, the model sits on their servers and everything I upload to them, everything I put into the model, everything that comes out can be seen. Most companies don't want to do this because, you know, you want to give some confidentiality here. But again, that's where AI comes in handy, right? Well, when we talk about these big models, there's usually a model before, which checks mm-hmm. what you put in there, and there's another model which comes after it, which checks what you put out there. And technically, they could even use an older model where they would just say, hey, they describe exactly the setup you just described. Model, please check. We gave access to Baidu. We want only Baidu to like check Baidu software, make sure they don't check anything mm-hmm. else here. Mm-hmm. But by the nature of whatever they're going to be checking here, is it's a security vulnerability, right? So if it's on their own software, I think there are incentives to patch them. But I mean, there could be technically backdoors in there, which they want to be in there, which is another debate.
Well, I mean, the U.S. government might not want us to patch Baidu, help Baidu patch its software. I imagine it doesn't. But I was just wondering. So I mean, Anthropic, when you use the API, which I guess all of these people would be doing, like Baidu would be using. The API, Anthropic can tell like which person is using the API, and they can, if they want. I mean, they don't do it, as you said. It wouldn't be a good reputation to get.
But right now, right, they have got like a restricted program. I think there's been some reports that like some API key leaked, and somebody else mm-hmm. used it for something.
Yeah.
And depending on how much incoming traffic you have, again, this costs a lot of computing time. Again, if you don't check for all of these things, what exactly is going on there? So it's a tricky problem, right? And like to some degree, as many things in the modern world, it relies on trust. Who do you give access to that they're doing the right things on these one, on these things? And a lot of times, they would also, for example, instead of checking source code, they would also check binaries, mm-hmm. right? And with binaries, it's like way harder to tell because you don't like, it's like machine language. It's just zeros and ones and like your assembler code. It's way harder to tell what it actually is. So if I upload a binary there, how do they know that this binary is something I coded, compiled myself versus what somebody else did? So yeah, you run into like many tricky territories here. On balance, it's probably, yeah, you give it to the good actors. And I think, I'm not sure if it's public. I think there's like this Project Glasswing is public. Who are the partners there? Hopefully they will expand. I don't even know when you qualify. What if I'm like a smaller software company and I also want to patch my vulnerabilities? Do they give me access? Do they not give me access? Do I need to pay for it? Do I not need to pay for it? And what I believe, eventually this shouldn't be like on the goodwill of a company here that we decide what they're doing here. Like we can argue, you know, like, oh, we got lucky. Anthropic is so nice, you know, they give us all 6 months to like patch our systems or whatever timeline is they give us.
Mm-hmm.
I think eventually for these kinds of things, government should get a heads up. Cybersecurity is a national security topic. Government mm-hmm. eventually needs to do something here. As a minimum, patch their own systems against adversaries. That seems like pretty important. And maybe beyond that, help industry also patch their systems on this one. And again, there's like multiple ways of going about this. And it seems... Well, we as a society or as a nation need to figure out how we're going to do this. Or we just say like, hey, there's a new model, we put it out there and let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. I think there's like some way of having a structured release with different amounts of periods where we can learn and then build this resilience and adaptation over time.
Yeah. Now, there are cases where national security and international security kind of merge. I mean, a famous example is bioweapons, you know, it's still, there's no consensus on whether COVID originated in a Chinese lab, but obviously it could have. And that you would think is grounds for America to kind of recognize that it can't really be secure from pandemics unless it has some idea of what's going on in a number of other countries. In other words, you need some kind of international governance in some sense.
Which we're trying to do with bioweapons, more or less successful, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's very little formal governance. The convention doesn't have even as much teeth as the Chemical Weapons Convention has. The Bioweapons Convention is kind of a normative thing. And, you know, you might argue that as it becomes easier and easier to do kind of gene splicing more and more inconspicuously. And of course, AI could strengthen the ability to do this. You might think you need a stronger international governance regime. In any event, I was going to ask whether the cyber hacking capability of AI, the hacking capabilities, is another example of that. You were on Rob Wiblin's 80,000 Hours podcast a couple of years ago, and I remember you and Rob talking about an AI. It was actually, it's interesting to listen to in now that Mythos has happened.
The years, right?
Yeah, it's been a while, but you guys were talking about this. It would be an AI that kind of got stronger as it went along. It would replicate itself, I guess. And in any event, it would exploit, you know, you were pointing out some limits on the ability of it to do this, but still, in theory, it could take over some computing power in various places and maybe learn things and get stronger. But anyway, the idea was, given how many things there are plugged into the internet, you can imagine such an AI, regardless of what nation it originated in, doing grave damage to a lot of nations. So that's kind of analogous to the bioweapons thing. So I guess you'd say that Mythos illustrates another dimension of the international governance challenge posed by AI.
Yeah, maybe I think where you can more easily find common ground, which is not about what is happening, it's more about who's doing it. I think maybe many nations would agree we want on terrorists to misuse these models, either for building bioweapons or for building cyber weapons, right? So we could basically agree on certain things there. Once you enter the military domain, things get incredibly complicated. It's incredibly hard to get any types of agreements there, and usually there are exceptions there. So like, let's just call it the civilian governance of AI. It's probably a thing where you can find more easily common ground. Mm-hmm. The civilian governance, for example, of like, how should we deal with like a bunch of actors not being like uplifted, having better cyber capabilities here. And I think for BioWonder, the case is more clear because it's just like bio versus all of us, which is like pretty bad. I hope at some point we come to agreements there. I think if I remember correctly, President Trump said something along these lines a while ago. They're actually doing like a speech at the UN. That's like, hey, we need to get this bio stuff to get it done together. Mm-hmm. On the cyber, I think you're pointing like to one scenario which many people describe as loss of control. But it's not like, it's not either the US or China or whoever bad guy, just AI on its own there and screwing with all of us. And,
or like, a don't super really bad agree. Guy, like a Dr. Evil, super bad guy or a rogue AI that could have been designed by a nation state initially, could have even been unleashed by a nation state that thought it could control it and confine it to its rival nation state or something.
Well, it's the same with bioweapons, unfortunately, right? But although I do think many people believe it's hard to control.
Well, you have to be pretty naive to think unleashing a bioweapon in another country would never, if it's truly contagious,
true.
Would never come back to haunt you.
A lot of times, right? Yeah. People were just like, oh, I'm just building this worm, which was meant for like
a Stuxnet, right? That got a little
The good thing about Stuxnet was it replicated around the world, but it didn't do anything because it only attacked if you have a centrifuge at home, right? Which is like, it was like pretty
narrow target here. Yeah, I don't have a centrifuge, right?
It's good, so I think you're not allowed to, actually.
I was safe. If people don't know, that's the joint Israeli-U.S. endeavor to incapacitate Iran's centrifuges, which was successful in and of itself. But then the Stuxnet, this kind of got kind of out of control. But as you point out, didn't take down any other centrifuges.
Indeed. So I think cyber seems harder to get agreements on, right? Uh-huh. But I think there's like certain ways to get agreements on it when we like talk about this loss of control, more autonomous AI and AI going out there replicating or even just messing with our internet, right? Like if we just have like AI spamming all of our forums and we just can't really differentiate between human mm-hmm. and AIs anymore, it might be like a shared interest. Like, hey, don't we want mm-hmm. like a nicer internet on these kinds of things? But even there, the internet is already so divided, might actually make it harder. And we talk about US and China on this one. It seems complicated, but I think eventually I'm with you. We need to have like some ways of verifying and agreeing here. And ideally we can like find shared standards, shared norms around these kinds of things, particularly if it comes from lone wolves or terrorists. I think there's like many, many things where we could agree on.
Yeah. One thing that concerns me is that racing dynamics make things more likely to get out of control. I mean, racing dynamics among companies, you know, for example, OpenAI, I'm unsure on the status. So is 5.5, is that Spud? Is that the next generation OpenAI model that is now out there or what? I mean, do you know?
It's not publicly known what exactly is like a new model, what is not. Yeah. We only know it's like 5.5, okay. Right? I think there have been like rumors that GPT-5 was actually not a new model. So it's mostly like this new rotor mechanism. Okay. And 5.5 now seems like pretty good. And I think I've read somewhere on Twitter that it's supposedly a new pre-train or like a new base model. But we don't know for certain,
but,
of these things. There are certain ways to test it. And I think at some point people were like reverse engineering, we have more clarity. But it certainly seems like a really good model. Which I think like the weird thing is it seems also really good on cyber, maybe as good as Mifid's. I haven't checked into this one yet.
That's what I'm getting to is like in theory, it is in OpenAI's commercial interest maybe to go ahead and now that Anthropic has taken Mythos out of commission for at least a little while, there's an incentive for OpenAI to be a little reckless even if its model is as good at hacking and go ahead and release it. So that's an example of a racing dynamic increasing risk. I think the same is true at the national level. And moreover, the race at the national level, the US-China rivalry has another way that it increases risk, which is that the AI companies use it as a talking point to keep from being regulated, right? So OpenAI says, oh no, you can't slow us down because we have to be China. Anthropic says that, and I think Dario really believes it. I don't think it's just a cynical talking point, but anyway. So this is, you know, I mean, as you may have gathered, I'm very concerned in general in that the AI revolution is going to really demand that we take international governance to a whole new level, and that right now we are not moving in that direction. And if anything, the AI kind of business dynamics and various other things encourage us to kind of intensify, in a certain sense, rhetorically and maybe ultimately really, the rivalry with China. I mean, do you acknowledge the trade-off there?
I totally acknowledge the trade-offs there. I think there are many races going on between nations, between companies. I would actually say right now the bigger races are between companies, not necessarily between nations. Like, we shouldn't forget, it's not like a state-run program, either in China or in the US. It's mostly companies doing their thing. And government involvement there, despite many people being concerned about it, is they've barely done anything, right? I mean, they've declared Anthropic supply chain risk beyond that, and they're helping a little bit for like getting more energy for building more data centers there, despite many of these things also just on the state level on all of this. And yeah, then you run into these concerns and worries you were just like talking about here. I do think, I mean, I would ask you, what do you propose, right? Because I think there's a real risk if you would just say, like, we actually just stop now. There needs to be, like, some type of coordination on these kinds of things. And there's nothing new. This is what we have with a bunch of technologies. This is what we had over the history of humanity in many ways. And I've got some hope we can do better this time. And I think we're slowly learning over time on all of these aspects. But I'm also just generally, like, really uncertain what's the best way forward here, given these many races, let's call it this way, which are going on.
Yeah, well, as long as you asked, my argument, which I make in my book, The God Test, which comes out in June, and which people could order if they wanted to pre-order. The reason it has a dramatic title is because I think very dramatic reform is warranted. I think we are going to need to become much more of a true global community to to handle the AI challenge. Mm-hmm. And there's going to, both in the sense that there's going to need to be stronger international governance than we've ever had, but also, and I want to ask you about this, AI is a very challenging technology to control. I mean, nuclear weapons are so much easier, right? Like, because just verification alone, like knowing what's going on in another country is a lot easier in principle than knowing. Well, actually, I mean, one thing you've emphasized is that one level where you can keep an eye on things is raw compute. That's relatively easy to monitor. Yeah. And I want to get back to that. But I do think, broadly speaking, it's a technology that's so challenging that you would like to have to kind of supplement formal governmental structures, what I call kind of organic transparency. In other words, the kind of understanding that you get about what's going on in another nation when you're on friendly terms and have economic engagement and cultural engagement and so on. And, you know, your scientists have a better idea what's going on with their scientists. And so I really think, you know, we are at a point where we need to get over like this war thing, you know, like and really recognize. I mean, I think it tangibly and demonstrably increases the non-zero-sum dynamics among nations and gives them it makes it more in their self-interest to cooperate. I think it does it by quite a big magnitude. And that's why I'm not necessarily optimistic about where things are going to be in 10 years. And I think we need to treat this as a very dramatic challenge that's going to force us to become, in a sense, better people, you know, just better able to get along with other groups of people.
Yeah. I mean, Bob, we both agree that AI is a big deal, right? But I think the majority of people are not there yet. And I think the majority of people will also initially have like different concerns about AI, right? I think many people now have concerns about the environmental impact. They don't want data centers in the backyard. And I think the most salient concern going forward in the future will be AI labor. And I think for all of these concerns for AI, it will be like, these will be fairly domestic issues. And you can even say they're worldwide issues, but we will deal with them like in terms of like with domestic tools. And kumbaya, I'd wish we would all come together and figure out what to do, right? it's just not the world we currently live in. And I think
not currently.
Going forward, I think I'm calling incrementalist, but I think we need to maybe step there one by one. Or at least find like niche carve outs so the same way we deal like with, for example, with the nuclear reality there. And even with the nuclear things, there's still bad guys out there. They're still building nukes. And I'm not a big fan of this, right? So I find myself in a position where I have two leading nations and one of them is a democratic nation and the other one is governed by a regime, which I'm not really a big fan of, which is suppressing people. And this is, for example, why I'm coming out in favor of export controls. I was like, well, I'd wish it would be different. But I think what export controls ideally can do is like take a little bit out of these race dynamics, but at least keeping a competitor a little bit wider, far out there. And then you have like a bigger gap. And then you could actually argue, actually, we don't need to worry about China right now. Imagine China would have built Memphis. Where would the discussion be at? It would be completely different, right?
Well, what? I mean, that's a good... See, I'm skeptical of the whole we should be terrified by China line. I mean, you said they repress their people. I'm not enthusiastic about all of those policies, but at the same time, it's far from clear to me that China wants to take over America and ruin my life. And I think the line between those two questions is kind of blurred. I mean, I also think, frankly, that when we look at how they treat their people and how we treat our people, we do it through the standard kind of, you know, cognitive bias lens that exaggerates the difference. And I don't mean it's not there, but I think we're more attentive to their sins than to ours. And I would also say, by the way, that like if you were an objective observer, like on Mars, and so he said, well, which is the more dangerous country, China or the U.S.? One thing that you would naturally observe is China has not staged a military attack on another country since 1979. The U.S. does it routinely in flagrant violation of the U.N. Charter, is responsible for the deaths of way more innocent people than China has even, you know, involuntarily, you know, incarcerated, right? Like, if you want to think about the Uyghurs, like, we have killed more innocent people I would say.
Well, I think the Chinese Revolution wasn't also, you know,
yeah, but
also
that's
many
over.
People
but
lost
that's
their life.
Over. I mean,
certainly. But so are many like of the bad things the US has done, right?
I think
I come out more positive on the US and just in terms of just like if you ask me about which system, right? I think we can look at many flaws currently going on, many flaws in history in both countries, and just like historic cases, just look at the raw numbers. But I'm a believer in democratic governance, and I just don't want to be ruled by Xi Jinping forever in many ways.
So you think he wants to take over the United States?
I don't necessarily think they want to take over the United States or the world. I do think they like project their power in many ways. For example, they want to take over Taiwan. I think the people of Taiwan probably don't want this.
Yeah, but you got to admit that's a pretty distinctive case. I mean, Taiwan used to be part of China. The official position of the U.S. government is that Taiwan and China are, in a sense, naturally part of the same polity, and we're fine. You know, we want them to unify peacefully, but, and in fact, we do not recognize Taiwan as a sovereign nation for that reason. So, I mean, I'm just not willing to extrapolate from the situation of the Taiwanese people, which I sympathize with, to me, some need for me to feel threatened. But
what do you think about
that,
like states like North Korea and states like Iran, which are being supported by China and being friend by them?
I think the Iranian people have a problem. We just bombed the shit out of them. That's a problem.
Sure, sure. But let's talk about like the bad guys in Iran who
to
America.
But
who are getting their rockets from, right? So I think there's just like many ways. We could have like a whole US-China debate here. And I think there's one side where I'm going to be coming out on all of this.
Yeah. No, I think there's a lot of things we haven't gotten to yet that are relevant. And I do want to explore this more deeply. Before we do, I want to say on the, you mentioned the employment issue. I mean, another concern of mine, my feeling about AI is, you can't totally dismiss even the sci-fi takeover scenarios, certainly can't dismiss very powerful rogue AI scenarios. But more than that, it just seems to me that if this thing proceeds full speed ahead, it is guaranteed to be destabilizing. Like, even if all the people who lose the jobs find new jobs, which I'm not convinced of, but it's still destabilizing when tons of people have to find new jobs all of a sudden. And there's a lot of dimensions of the social impact that I think will be destabilizing. And I'd say two things about that that are relevant to China, which is that it makes me think that slower is better in terms of the rate of AI advance. And if you ask, why can't we slow down? The answer you get is China. The fear of China is brought up. The other thing I'd say is if you're worried about authoritarianism, a famous cause of authoritarianism is things getting out of control in the first place. And I assume you're familiar with some tendencies of our current president in America. One can imagine that if things get out of control because AI advances so fast, in part because people keep saying, but China, we have to race ahead and get so far ahead that whatever, you can imagine authoritarian creeping in through the back door, right? And especially since AI is a technology so conducive to use by authoritarians if they manage to monopolize
it. Oh, absolutely. It's the best weapon you can potentially have. Again, reason why I don't want China to have it. Mm-hmm. I think you said guarantee to be destabilizing. I'm a little bit just like, I don't know. And I think like the speed factor is key here, right? We've been going through job displacements for the history of humanity. But if it's a little bit slower, usually we figure our stuff out. I think there's generally this whole stream when I think about AI, which we call adaptation, resilience, which is like things will change, right? And we just got to adapt to it. And I think the worry of AI, in particular if AI is going to be building the next AI, it's just going to be incredibly fast. Right. And as me in my personal life, but as us as a society, if things are really fast, we usually like screw it up. I don't think the factor, the reason why we go at the speed which we're currently going is China. I think even if we change China out of debate, I would still be skeptical that people would actually regulate AI. Because there's simply not enough consensus yet, right? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, we both might agree on just like, whoa, things could be really scary. We got to be more cautious. There's still other people who just believe like, well, dude, there's like so much good things it can bring. Technology broadly has brought many, many, many good things. Why don't we get there as fast as possible? Like my relatives are dying of cancer. What are you talking about here?
Right.
So even that debate is like still there. So there's like all of these debates at the same time with the China one. And I think even if we take China out of the equation, we would agree on that. I think this will change in the future. I hope it will change in the future. So if these dangers become more clear, people are more a little bit more clear-eyed that this is quite a unique position we're in right now in terms of what we're building with AI. And then I just hope that we can have like the China discussion in terms of like an agreement, or there's a sufficient gap people would actually agree on slowing down, or there's like small types of agreement. I don't think we will have a world governed by them. We're just going to figure all of this out. I think we need to carve out like small agreements where we then can collectively go forward here. But none of this is guaranteed. And again, none of this is like the debates are still there. And even if I take out China, I still have the other debate. And even if I take these people out, there's probably another person who debate me and say, like, we all disagree on this. AI is just, man, it's just everything, right? that's just the problem. We talk about like this incredibly general purpose technology here. Yep. And having like sane debates about it is just like incredibly hard.
Yes, but so far we have maintained our sanity, right? Even if I raise my voice, we have maintained our sanity. So,
trying to, yeah.
So, listen, as regular listeners and viewers know, what we generally do here is after about this long, we go into overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. And I'm really glad you've agreed to stick around, because I want to keep, pressing you on the China matter and have you press me back on whatever you want to press me on. I also do want to get into the Jensen Huang Dwarkesh podcast, which maybe you can do some exegesis on. There's a link in the show notes if you want to become a paid subscriber to Non-Zero newsletter and watch or listen to the rest of this. There's also, if you just go to nonzero.org, you'll see the post for this podcast. That's another avenue. Before we go, I want you, first of all, tell us, what is your Twitter handle? Because that's how I first discovered you. Twitter.
It's O Leonard. It's O-H and then L-E-N-N-A-R-T. Yeah, if I share anything or going to write something more in the future, this will certainly be shared via Twitter.
Okay, great. So with that, thanks everybody who's followed us this far. Hope you'll follow us into overtime. And we'll, in any event, see you next time.